to our listeners to what is our very first podcast here from the University of Oxford. My name is Professor Irene Tracy, and I have the good fortune of being the Vice Chancellor at this fabulous university where we've got amazing researchers and fabulous staff. And what we thought we'd do is experiment. I'm an experimentalist, and try something a little new and different and start to bring some of that amazing content that we have here in the university from our researchers and our teaching staff and our staff supporting our great mission of teaching and research to you. And so again, welcome to this podcast, and I'm absolutely thrilled that just coming out of the back of International Women's Day last week, being a woman myself from STEM, I wanted to highlight our women in STEM. And so today I have for our very first podcast, Professor Sonia Contera, who is from the Department of Physics. Welcome, Sonia. And we have a DPhil student, Misha Patel, who is from the Engineering Department. So two fantastic departments here in the Division of Maths and Physical Life Sciences, and two fabulous women who I know we're going to have a terrific conversation with. So welcome both of you to the podcast, and thank you for giving up your time this morning. Can I start with you, Sonia? I think it'd be really helpful for the listeners just to hear a little bit about your area of research, and maybe if you want to touch on a little bit your journey to this place as well. Tell us about what your research is.
I am a physicist, and I work in biological systems. As a physicist, I have physics question, like why the universe created matter that was soft and that matter became alive. But also have an experimental physics interest in the matter, and also understanding and supporting other research that is going in biological and medical sciences with my techniques. So I like to create techniques such as the usually based in the atomic force microscope that allows us to understand how biological systems are constructed from the nanometer scale up mechanically, and how that system that is dissipating energy, using energy, becomes able to be alive, and try to use this knowledge to create maybe new therapeutics or support people.
As a person that's worked in neuroimaging my whole career, you know, I value the contribution that people coming from your discipline and strength and background brings to the biological and the medical sciences. Without really physicists, we wouldn't have all the technologies and the ways that we can, again, better understand life on Earth. So, yeah, very, very, very interesting. Well, let me turn to Misha. Let's hear it. You're in a very different sort of space. Tell us about your work.
Yeah, so I'm an engineer. My background is in mechanical engineering, and I've always been interested in using engineering to make the world a more sustainable place. I've had a keen interest in sustainability throughout my studies, and at the moment I'm doing my PhD in offshore renewable energy, specifically in tidal stream energy, and I'm focusing on the UK, mainly on a case of the north coast of Scotland, and trying to quantify the resource so that we can kind of know how much tidal stream energy we can actually get in the UK, and how we can use that with other forms of renewable energy like wind or solar, to really support renewable energies.
Yeah, and drive the whole green technology. Indeed. I mean, there's been a lot of talk about the tidal, you know, opportunities. How optimistic are you that this is really going to be something that we could deliver as an alternative energy source for us?
Yeah, you're not wrong at all. Tidal energy, I suppose, when you compare it to something like offshore wind, it's very young. You're dealing with turbines underwater. Yeah. That's always going to be much more difficult. You've got bigger forces because of the density of the water and things like that. But I think there's a significant potential for tidal stream energy. Something I particularly look at is what are the constraints limiting it, and trying to work out what actually is our viable energy at the end of that. But hopefully I'd have to be quite positive about it. but the UK, I mean, we're in a really fortunate position with the resource that we have in the UK.
And going back to you, Sonia, you've written this book, Nano Comes to Life. Why did you do that? What was it? I mean, it's not easy to, in the day job, find time to write a book for the public.
I had a story to tell. I wanted to also... Part of the frustration of entering a new world, the world of biology as a physicist, and being so difficult to do multidisciplinary research, that is so difficult to actually be able to combine the disciplines that you think you need to combine to make progress. So I was interested in how and why historically physicists enter the nanoscale with techniques such as mine or nanoparticles and all that. We all arrive to nanotechnology at the same time, and how that progressively led us to biology. both to develop tools to understand the basic mechanisms of biology at the nanometer scale, proteins, mm-hmm. etc., but also to develop nanomedicines, and that how that is transforming the way we're doing biology, and I also think the way we're doing part of physics, that interface between physics and biology, which is now everywhere, from computer science to understand intelligence, to create new materials, to create new robots, all sorts of technologies depend on this convergence of physics and biology. So I wanted to explore that in that book, yeah. and what does it mean for the future of what we understand, I think, about biology, and also the physics we will do in the future.
Yeah, and share the excitement of it. Yeah, so yep. that is Nano Comes to Life, for those who yes. are looking for a stocking filler maybe for next Christmas or earlier indeed. Well, let's change tack a little bit, and we'll come back to sort of at the end maybe just where your science is going and what you see as the next exciting step for yourselves. But let's go back to sort of where it all began, and maybe I can turn to Misha just to say, so were you always interested in science at school? Was this something that you knew from young you wanted to do? Were you inspired by anybody in particular at school, a school teacher or somebody else?
Yeah, so I think, I mean, definitely I have a lot to thank my teachers for. I was really lucky that the school I went to, I was encouraged to pursue STEM. I always loved maths. I can't say I loved maybe all the sciences as much as I loved maths, but I definitely loved maths and I did enjoy physics as well. And I would say that there's two, three teachers that really come into mind when I think about who inspired me and kind of shaped me to kind of be in engineering now. Two of whom were actually my maths teachers, and they really fostered my love for the subject. And I don't suppose I probably realised it at the time, but looking back now, I think it was really powerful to actually see two, they were both women who were actually also South Asian, as really brilliant, talented mathematicians. And so now when I look back at that, I think that would have had a really big impact on me. And the third teacher was my form tutor, so he never taught me a subject. He actually taught French. And he just really instilled confidence in myself and my classmates. He really encouraged us to stand up, speak up, question things. He'd come in with, you know, a topic each day, each week, and get us to, you know, tell us our opinions about it. So, yeah, I think all of those sort of factors have kind of played into where I am now and today.
Yeah, no, it just, I mean, it speaks, I mean, you spoke so well there about just the importance of teachers, but also the visibility issue, which often, and that's been my experience too, you don't recognise actually how important it is, as you say, to have that visibility at the time. But on reflection, you realise actually that really did unlock the belief, you know, that you can go and do, you know, that subject and to, you know, pursue your dream. And again, I think, you know, I'm a big, obviously as an educator myself, I'm a passionate believer in the importance of teachers, you know, in our society, and just the amazing role that they play and how much more we should value them and show our value of them in this country and beyond. So Sonia, your journey was sort of here, you know, you've come to us from outside of our shores. So tell us a little bit about sort of where you were inspired and your journey to Oxford.
I had a complicated journey to science and to Oxford. I grew up in the Canary Islands in Fuerteventura just after the dictatorship of Franco ended. So it was a hopeful time in Spain, but I was in an island with, there was not much resources. We didn't even have very regular school. We had lots of holidays. So I was great because I just spent a childhood running wild in between volcanoes and sea. My parents were not educated either. So it never occurred to me I was going to study. Then we moved to Madrid and I think from my missing nature, I think, got me interested in physics, missing my life in the island. Mm. And I was a teacher, a female teacher of physics. Yeah. And I always remember the day where we were doing gravitation. And the first time I realized that I could use my intuition to express how I think things will happen in the future in the natural world with mathematics. That magical moment where you can express an intuition in math, it was this act of magic that right. said, I have to be a physicist.
It's a lightning bolt moment.
And there was no going back. Mm-hmm. So then I studied physics in Madrid. I didn't like it. I didn't like the middle class environment. I didn't fit. I was good at languages, and I started traveling. I went to Russia, then I went to China through scholarships. I did my PhD in Japan, interested in how Japan became a technological country. And a bit by chance, I ended up in Oxford.
Fantastic.
Yeah. I must say, in Oxford, I found there was a place for my love of physics that I had not found anywhere else.
Oh, I'm pleased to hear that. Yeah.
I found colleagues with whom I share this deep love of the subject. Mm. And I think that kept me here.
Yeah, the passion for it. Yeah. I mean, we do have that here, don't we? We're so fortunate to have colleagues that are so passionate about their subject areas. And, you know, that naturally is spilling into the teaching element as well, you know, and that's why I think, you know, our USP is about having those frontline researchers do the teaching, because that can be really inspiring then for the next generation. But, you know, we spoke a little bit about sort of women and visibility. I mean, you're obviously a senior professor in the department, and, you know, I'm interested to explore, you know, what you see as some of the, you know, the opportunities, but also the challenges as a woman in STEM in terms of other women following in your path. Could you just maybe describe a little bit, you know, what you've observed and you know, what you see as some of the ways we can do things, you know, better, that you could share with both me as Vice Chancellor, but also with, you know, maybe some of the younger career women like Isha, you know, listening to you?
I never had an easy career. I always felt I didn't fit in any of the stages of my career, that I didn't fit where I was. It was not just because of I was a woman. I think it was class as well. It was it's many things. It's very intersectional, the way your career progresses. I think that the challenge is we are very few women in physics and in engineering, and many of and the stereotypes still are very strong. Women struggle to handle both the personal career, the career and the personal life. And there's no going away from this. We live in a society that has not valued women in our subject, particularly in physics. Physics has a history of misogyny. Many of the biggest myths of physics have publicly expressed very misogynistic views. And this is still in the subject. So I think we need, it's very hard to understand all this when you're a young woman, why you feel so bad, why you don't fit. And I think the key to all this is to start deconstructing these identities of science, which is we're doing. We're doing now in MPLS through some of the programs we are doing of
so I should say MPLS is the Maths and Physical Maths Life Sciences Division. Yeah.
So deconstruct what is the identity of a science and help women to understand why they don't feel okay, that other women are feeling the same as them, creating networks, trying to create a collective understanding of how we can support people to change their local environment so they are accepted.
I think having, as you say, more visible role models and having those conversations, I mean, how do you see that improving and what more could we
be
doing?
We need to be honest. We need to explain the good part and the bad part of our careers. Role models need to be real, I think. Mm-hmm. We need to be authentic. Also, we need to show the role models, maybe they are not so high up in the hierarchy, but people that have very fruitful and interesting and careers, that they help a lot of people, that all the students do very well, that they have collaborations with the local communities. And these are very valuable careers we also need to
And we should be celebrating
show.
And making visible.
There's not a single career for women in STEM. We have to run away from the stereotype of women in STEM, I think. Because as one thing you discover in science is that you only become a good scientist when you are absolutely yourself.
Yeah.
You can only do good science when you are very authentic.
Yeah.
And this is what we should promote and explore more. We need to communicate this, I think.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, when I was a head of department, you know, one of the things I observed when we were, you know, celebrating our women from our research staff and clinical staff and support staff, and talking about, you know, the career trajectories was actually expressing to the younger generation that there wasn't this magic template of one model that you suddenly had to find and that was the secret of success. Every single person who had progressed their career had taken a different journey and a different route there that was, you know, difficult or was less difficult. It was a range, but they found their way through their own personal journey. And again, as you say, that means that it's authentic for them. And I think that was quite eye-opening, actually, for some of the younger researchers that, you know, there wasn't this mystery thing that we somehow were hiding from them. It generally is difficult, and but there are people there that can help you and support you, and never to not ask for help. I think that's one of the things I often say to young researchers is, you know, really, honestly, very few people are not going to help you if you ask them for help and give you advice and support you. And so really inculcating that sense of, as you said, getting them to talk together, to create networks, to create mentorship, and to champion each other, to really, behind the scenes, be championing that person, making it visible, you know, doing things like this, you know, getting people to come and have a platform to be able to talk about their work. You know, this is the way that we can, again, highlight and support, you know, particularly our women, I think, in STEM. Misha, let's turn to you and hear a little bit from your perspective at the sort of early stage of a career, how you have found, you know, particularly Oxford, in terms of, you know, as a woman in STEM and in engineering, what you see as, you know, some of the things that have been, you know, good and not so good and that we could improve on.
Absolutely. So I think you mean, Sonia and yourself mentioned networks, and that's been a huge part of my time here at Oxford. It's been a huge part of my support group as well, like support community. So when I joined Oxford, one of the first things I looked for was a sort of a women in STEM, women in engineering network. And not long after, the engineering department were relaunching their women in engineering network. So within my first year, I joined the steering committee group for that as vice president. And I was on that committee for 2 years and vice president for the majority of that time. And it was it had a huge impact on my experience here. The colleagues I had throughout the network were fantastic. And it also really gave us a chance to discuss with the department at, you know, senior levels, what we can be implementing, how we can be, you know, supporting women. And the second network is the Black Indigenous People of Colour in STEM network, so the BIPOC STEM network, which I think was founded maybe shortly before I joined Oxford. And I joined that as a member and then recently became co-convener. And Sonia's also mentioned intersectionality, which I feel extremely passionate about. I think it's absolutely key to keep intersectionality at the forefront of the conversation regarding EDI, equality, diversity, inclusion, because I don't really think you can achieve any EDI aims without considering that. So that's been a huge part. And I have to mention the professional services staff who have been absolutely instrumental in supporting us as networks through mm-hmm. women in engineering. So the EDI coordinators in MPLS, the events team and access and outreach team at engineering. And then obviously as a student, there's lots of people within the department and my college that have been absolutely fantastic and supportive. I've got a great supervision team.
You're at St. Cat's.
Yeah, so I'm at St. Catherine's. Mm-hmm. And they've been absolutely fantastic. And my supervision team within the engineering department, so Professor Tom Adcock, Dr. Amanda Smythe, and I have another supervisor in Edinburgh, have been incredibly supportive, not only in terms of my research, which absolutely, yeah, they're fantastic supervisors, but also really supportive of the work that I do with these networks internally with the university and also other EDI things that I do externally. So I think that's a huge part. Mm. And in terms of what we can do better, I think where I've been so involved in networks, something I really realised is how important it is to recognise the contribution that these networks make.
Yeah.
I think it's so important. Something is to actually value the time and effort that's being put into it and giving appropriate compensation for that time and effort. Because I don't think it does show appreciation for the value and benefits that it's providing the university. But I also think it's the only way to make these efforts sustainable.
Yeah, yeah. No, you've touched on so many important things there. You're absolutely right. And I think that sort of reward system, for want of a better expression, is something that, again, you know, I'm very interested in looking at in terms of how we can, you know, better, again, put that value system and explicitly, as you say, compensate, as you put it, for the effort that's gone in, because we have to sort of put real meaning behind it and make sure that there's traction so that what's coming out of those networks actually bites and carries through. And I have to say, I've been you know, like you commented, you know, the division MPLS has been really terrific with its EDI. I mean, it's really, you know, an exemplar of how they've done it. And, you know, and I do congratulate Sam Howison, you know, as the head of the division that's, you know, really taken this on and championed it right from the very top. And that's sort of what we need. We need the leaders and the men to really take ownership as well of the challenges and to meet it. So let's round off just sort of hearing about where next then for your science. I'm interested to hear sort of, Sonia, what's your big exciting project at the moment, and where do you hope to take things?
Yes, I'm putting together a collaboration between neuroscientists, engineers, and physicists to try to understand how neurons communicate with each other. So the neural networks that we hear in computing, but actually in life, trying to understand the physics of how they communicate to each other and beat to each other. And actually, even more recently, we're trying to think if we can try to explore if neurons exploit quantum resources and if this can be an interesting avenue, not only for understanding biology, but also for developing new technologies such as quantum sensors for biological purposes.
Wow, that's so cool. Well, it's music to my ears as a neuroscientist. I applaud you for that, and it'd be good to follow up with you and keep the conversation alive so I can find out how that's going. And Misha, how about you? Sort of when do you hope to wrap up, and what do you hope to do after your doctorate?
Yeah, so obviously the main focus at the moment is completing the doctorate. So I'm looking forward to kind of working on my final couple of chapters of work. At the moment, I'm looking at deploying different types of turbines in one site and how much we can actually work out what the sacrifice of energy is when we're only deploying one type of turbine, which has been really exciting. And I think beyond the PhD, once I've finished, I'm really looking forward to kind of, I'd like to really bridge a gap between industry and academia. So we've discussed the private sector. And yeah, I'd love to sort of really work on tidal energy and how we can actually get the energy connected to the grid and things like that. I mean, I don't work on the energy storage side. I very much work on quantifying the resource. But for us to actually develop these sites, we need to have a number on the resource to make sure that we're, you know, effectively extracting it. So I'd like to really work on that side of things, and especially the policy as well.
Well, the world will be your oyster. I'm absolutely sure of it, you know, with the training and the background you've got and the energy and the commitment. Sonia, Misha, thank you so much for spending this time this morning. I've really enjoyed meeting you both, and I know that the listeners will be absolutely captivated by what you've been able to share. So thank you to the listeners for listening. We hope to do another podcast next term, to be decided yet what the subject area will be, but it'll be another stellar lineup, I'm absolutely confident. I wish you both all the best going forwards, and thank you once again for joining us.